Judge Van Dusen, Attorney General, my colleagues here, some of them from the Asia Pacific Forum on National Human Rights Institutions, and members of the audience and friends. I was delighted that the attorney began by discussing Doc Evatt. He was one of my great heroes as a young international lawyer, and I thought I'd bring today this rather condescending photograph of Clement Attlee in London, not long after the United Nations Charter, of course, came into force. Doc Evatt had in fact been very instrumental in drafting the basic provisions of the United Nations Charter as well as the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and I always find this one of Clement Attlee adjusting his tie a rather sort of patronising and post-colonial approach, but nonetheless one from which we've clearly moved on. I wanted to take up, if I may, the theme of the importance of Australia's engagement with international human rights law, with the perhaps initial statement that while Australia may have come in from the cold, the wind has rather been taken out of my sails. For the typical role of an international lawyer over the last few years, whether in the United Kingdom, Europe or North America, has been to berate their respective government ministers with numerous failings and to list the necessary and obvious reforms that one would want. In Australia's case, these have been to persuade the government to end its contribution to the Coalition of the Willing, to increase its engagement in the UN Human Rights Committees, particularly in the reporting requirements, ratify the optional protocols of human rights instruments, including the Torture Convention, adopt a charter for human rights, end mandatory detention for refugees and asylum seekers, implement human rights treaties directly in Australian law, respond to Indigenous needs, and support appropriately those Australian nationals who might be in detention in Guantanamo Bay or elsewhere overseas. Well, perhaps international lawyers have become a little predictable, but we certainly weren't particularly effective in those years, those dark years, and it's been particularly gratifying for me to observe the change in government policy in the early days of its term in office that placed Australia firmly back on the road to a strong and meaningful engagement with international human rights law. To quote the Prime Minister, Australia's back in business with an explicit mandate to strengthen Australia's engagement with the UN system. We now have some straight talking with China. We're seeking a seat in the Security Council. I understand from the paper the other day that we're even seeking advice to bring Iran and Ahmadinejad to the ICJ or the International Criminal Court. We are seeking to strengthen the Human Rights Council, where a recent announcement has been made that refugees will be automatically qualified to apply for permanent visas. We have a recognition of Kosovo, despite difficulties within the Security Council. Efforts at humanitarian assistance in Burma, and various advances that we've heard from the attorney on consultations to become a party to the optional protocol on torture. So one might very well ask, what on earth do I have left to talk about? I've spent many years discussing many of those questions. And I would like now to discuss why I think it's a continuing important mission for Australia to maintain its engagement and to reinvigorate that engagement promised by our new government. I should, however, though, confirm a point again that the attorney has made, is that Australia has played an historically very strong role in the drafting and development of human rights instruments. Coming in from the cold is not an entirely accurate picture, partly for the sort of effort that people like Doc Evatt made, but we know that Australia's played a quite extraordinary role in fostering peacekeeping forces around the world since they were first established in the late 1940s in the Middle East and Congo. We have forces in the region, Papua New Guinea, Bougainville, East Timor, the Solomons, and we have a program of development aid that of course could do with improvement, but nonetheless it has been an astonishing contribution in many respects. Despite these contributions, however, and one must in fairness acknowledge them, recent practices by Australia over the last few years with respect to refugees and asylum seekers, Indigenous peoples, joining the Coalition for the Willing in the war in Iraq, the apparent endorsement of the Bush Doctrine for preemptive attack, have diminished, in my view, Australia's reputation as a strong advocate for human rights. but I believe we now have the opportunity to map our current policies to consider the opportunities that we have in the future. Engagement with the international system is, I think, fundamental for some of the reasons that have been outlaid by the attorney. And I'd like to go through some of them. Some are fairly obvious, I think, to all of you. By being a member of the Security Council, if we achieve that in the next couple of years, ratifying treaty protocols, attending international conferences on law reform, we're obviously better able to influence the development of international laws and policy. And indeed, of course, the acts and activities of international organisations in ways, of course, that not only meet international standards of human rights but which support Australian interests. It's always a good strategy for lawyers, as many of you will know, to be the first ones to draft the document, because you've got some chance of having a continuing role and achieving your objectives at the end of it. It's also important, and again the attorney made this point, but not many people do, that international human rights law to a very significant degree gives effect to rules and practices that we have established in domestic law. It's a quite an interesting circular system in which international law provides principles and ideas for the international legal system, and equally the international legal system feeds back into new policies, and we're seeing that with attempts to ensure that Australian legislation meets the requirements for the Disability Convention on ratification. I also think it's very important, and has proved to be very important, to be part of the international human rights complaint system, because it's been through these procedures that the substance of international human rights law has developed to the quite sophisticated stage that it's now reaching, and Australia can be very important in fostering those developments of law. But there are some other ideas that I'd like to suggest to you beyond those ones that I'm sure you're reasonably well aware of, and there are two that I'd like to raise. One is that I think that some form of Charter of Human Rights will rescue Australia from its relative isolation from the intellectual developments of legal cultures of human rights that have been the foundations for our own legal traditions. And the second is the point that the United Nations Charter itself readily recognised not so much the rule of law, as the attorney points out, but the vital link between human rights and international peace and security, and indeed the entire United Nations system is based upon an understanding of that linkage and the contribution that human rights makes to achieving an ordered, peaceful and just society. But first, if I might, I'd like to just develop the idea of what I fear has been the intellectual isolation of Australia from jurisprudential developments. The Chief Justice Spiegelman in New South Wales commented 10 years ago that one of the strengths of Australian common law has been the ability to draw on a vast body of experience from other common law jurisdictions. Now, both Canada and England, and to a lesser extent New Zealand, may progressively be removed as sources of influence and inspiration. Australian common law is threatened with a degree of intellectual isolation that many would find disturbing. Today, most legal systems in Europe are informed by reference to the European Convention on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, and similarly, of course, New Zealand, Canada, the United States and the United Kingdom have human rights charters of one form or another. The experiment in Victoria and the Australian Capital Territory has been heartening, and we've seen the very interesting case with Justice Bernard Bongiorno in the Kelly Gray case, where without the matter being raised by counsel, interesting in itself, he applied the Victorian Charter on Human Rights and the right to trial without unreasonable delay. Has been a very interesting advance. But my central point is to understand the isolation that Australia has been in because we have not been connected with some form of human rights charter or legislation. And I'd like to explore this idea very briefly in the context of a very important case of the House of Lords last June in Alskaney. And it concerned the legal question as to whether the Department of Defence had acted unlawfully in not holding an inquiry into the deaths of six Iraqis caused by members of the British Armed Forces in Iraq. In respect of one of those deaths, Mr. Bassa Musa had been taken to the British military base in Basra, where he was beaten to death by British military authorities. They were pretty much accepted facts. The question of whether or not there should be a judicial review of this death depended on whether the public authority had acted incompatibly with the European Convention on Human Rights. And the answer depended in part on whether the Human Rights Act in the United Kingdom has an extraterritorial effect to apply in Iraq. In other words, will the act of a British officer in an overseas prison managed by the British authorities be subject to the human rights standards? It's a very interesting question and a difficult question for international law, the extraterritorial effect of legislation, but a question that's rather difficult to answer in the Australian context unless it's clear as a matter of statutory interpretation. Here, the House of Lords examined the European Convention and looked at a number of cases, the Bank of Vic and Belgium arising from the missile attacks by NATO on a building in Belgrade in 2001, and examination also of another case emerging from Turkey, also going to the European Court of Human Rights, ISA and Turkey, where some shepherds were killed in northern Iraq by Turkish troops. And the issue raised in all of these cases was whether or not the Human Rights Act and convention could have an extraterritorial effect based on the jurisdictional control of the officers or military forces concerned. Now, to cut a rather long story short, the House of Lords concluded that at least in relation to the individual who had been beaten to death in the Basra prison, the United Kingdom's Human Rights Act applied directly to those activities, despite the fact that they were out of the territorial jurisdiction of the United Kingdom. Now, in discussing that question and in tracing the evolution of the jurisprudence, we find that a major court, the House of Lords, examined an international treaty on human rights, and they examined the national practices of courts and examined the legal thinking of the European Court of Human Rights. And in this way, it was possible to advance jurisprudence on the human rights consequences of individual actions. My wider point is that the Human Rights Act informs and influences all aspects of British law, whether it's competition law, tax, property law, environmental law, or the operation of the public services. And in this way, one can hardly look at any area of European and British law without coming into contact with the Human Rights Act. And I think that to be isolated from these sorts of jurisprudential developments predicted by the Chief Justice Spiegelman is a very significant worry for us. In discussing why the engagement in international human rights law is important, my first somewhat negative point then is that the absence of commitment to a human rights charter or similar document and the failure to engage in the system leaves Australia behind in contemporary thinking about and the implementation of human rights in a globalised environment. Well, my second and rather more positive point is one that the attorney has made, and that is that human rights and the international rule of law are directly linked by the Charter to international peace and security. That in short, international law matters because international peace and security matters. International human rights law matters to individuals, to national and international body politics, and to the future of healthy democracies. Indeed, I think it's extremely interesting that the international and domestic communities increasingly demand that national governments act according to the rule of law. An example lies, and I love to cite this one, of the opinion polls conducted in the weeks prior to the invasion of Iraq by the Coalition of the Willing. 70% of those polled in the US, UK, Europe and Australia accepted that the war was justified if and legal if there was a Security Council authorization. By contrast, 70% of that polled group were against the threatened invasion of Iraq if the coalition were to go ahead without authorization. Now, I can't imagine for a minute that the wider public really understands the legal intricacies of the operation of the Security Council. But what is interesting is that the public increasingly will judge the rightness and the legal rightness of an act significantly by reference to whether it meets the rule of law. Now, that's not to debate the rightness in law of the invasion in Iraq, but it's interesting that we have an increasingly informed public that is demanding a rule of law approach to these questions. I've raised the example of the Iraq war because it underscores the point that human rights are more likely to be at risk at times of conflict than at any other time. While we might agonize about whether the asserted threat of terrorism justifies detention without trial for 2 days or seven, civil and international conflict lead to the deaths of tens, if not thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. The conflicts in Sudan, former Yugoslavia, the NATO bombing of Kosovo under the guise of humanitarian intervention, the invasion of Afghanistan on grounds of self-defense, and the war in Iraq have breached the rule of law, not necessarily because they were wrong in the first instance or illegal, but because they violated quite simple rules of necessity and proportionality. I feared in these enlightened days in Australia that it would be rather churlish of me to dwell, as I have briefly, on the past, but I believe that we should remind ourselves how easy it was in these last few years to be seduced by the language of preemptive attacks, unlawful combatants, waterboarding and other forms of interrogation, detention without trial in a war against terror, and the contrived logic of an implied Security Council authorization for the use of force. Australians, too, it seems, are vulnerable to being drawn into the vortex of deceptive language, camouflaging violations of fundamental prohibitions on torture and inhumane treatment, etc. Indeed, as we come in from the cold, the light has illumined the horror of these distorted, asserted concepts of international law and the dangerous path upon which Australia had embarked. The lesson to be learned is, of course, eternal vigilance in ensuring that we have an educated Australian and international public that can respond to clear breaches of international human rights law. Just a moment before I conclude, I'd like to just think a little bit about the future. And I agree also that in the 21st century, we're going to see new opportunities for engagement internationally. And I think it's going to be the century of implementation of substantive rights, as distinct from the 20th century emphasis on articulating her human rights in international legal instruments. I think it's time to focus on the enforcement of rights with a greater emphasis on economic and social rights, group rights of minorities and indigenous peoples. The recent natural disasters confirm this direction, as tsunamis, monsoons, earthquakes expose the vulnerability of thousands of people and the weaknesses of their governments in responding. We may see many more such human rights catastrophes as the consequences of global warming becomes more apparent, including disease and the scarcities of food and energy. Australia has an opportunity to build again on the foundations that other governments have created, and to develop its leadership, I think most particularly in the Asia-Pacific region. I do deeply believe in the work of the Asia-Pacific Forum of National Human Rights Institutions, and I know that Heriok is connected with that and supports its activities. I really can't think of anything more exciting and meaningful to work on, because one is really, as an Australian, having an opportunity to teach and to discuss human rights processes that can give a meaningful implementation to these issues. I'd also think it very important for the Australian government to think more about the concept of collective and individual responsibilities to protect. We're already seeing the Secretary-General in Burma, I believe, at the moment, talking to the government, trying to put some meaning onto this concept of the United Nations community obligation to respect. You won't be surprised, as the Dean of a Law Faculty, that I think training and education are really fundamental to engaging internationally, and I would like to see us doing a lot more regional work in working on understanding the principles of international human rights law, and possibly also international humanitarian law, of course something Australia is in any event bound to do by virtue of the Red Cross conventions that it has signed. I'd also like to suggest, and this again is perhaps a little personal, but I do think that Australia needs an institute for international law and human rights, having come from the British context where I saw the importance of a relatively independent and objective research body talking about the standards of human rights and international law. I can see the immense value of that, and I think it would be a leadership role in Australia were we eventually to move into that area. Well, finally then, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak about this subject. I wish the Attorney good luck in achieving and implementing the government policies. I can assure him that international lawyers such as I will continue to hold his feet to the fire, but nonetheless that we know and wish you luck in achieving these policies. We hope you fully realise that the legal profession and legal academics and the universities will want to assist you in every way they can. Thank you very much.